One housekeeping thing is it's come to my attention that we have a listenership that extends beyond this room. So what I've done on this source sheet, which you have here, I'm going to upload it to YU Torah, is I've put my email address on the top in case anyone needs to get in contact. And then at the very end, on the second page, I've embedded a link to a survey just to get a sense of who our listeners are, how they listen, what they like, what they don't like, and try to see if we can maybe improve this class and expand it in some fashion. So anyone who has a chance, I feel like I already know a lot about the people who are in the class, who come in person, but if people are interested in giving feedback, so a link to the survey is provided, and any feedback is much appreciated. Right.
Do you have any idea of how many are listening to it on the outside?
Well, we're gonna find out, I guess.
Obviously, more than one. I know Nathan Lowe listens to it.
Oh, fantastic! All right.
Since I heard you talk last week.
That's why I listen to it.
I know your father.
Hey, all right. The more the merrier. All right. So what we're gonna do this time is something that we've actually done before, not in the context of this class. We did it over Shavuos. I've since had time to revisit some of the conclusions that we came to. I've modified some of our conclusions based on a very important contribution to historical scholarship by a teacher of mine, a wonderful, wonderful man, a big Talmud Chacham, and an excellent scholar named Sasha Stern, who teaches at the University of London at UCL. What I'd like to do is, I'd like to transition our discussion from where it's been the last couple of weeks into where it's going to go in the next few classes, and that is to say, we've slowly panned in from our panoptic view at 20,000 feet. We've been looking at major phenomena that impact, I think, the full spectrum of the Jewish community or of Jewish communities in Eretz Yisrael in the first few centuries of the Common Era. There's what to say about Jews in the diaspora, but this semester we've mostly confined ourselves to Eretz Yisrael. We've looked at synagogues, where synagogues come from, where how Jewish prayer instantiates over the first couple of hundred years of his existence. We've looked at how rabbis, panning in a little bit, we've looked at how rabbis have been able to interact with that broader culture, and then we began to focus in a bit more specifically on how rabbis and people who associate with rabbis either were impacted or themselves impacted the specific Jewish environment, whether it be in the legal sphere or whether it be in terms of aesthetics, art in the synagogue. So really what all of this has been leading up to is a question which we're going to have to confront, which is how, in fact, do rabbis themselves begin to coalesce into a fully recognizable class that will eventually accumulate a good deal of influence in Jewish society as the centuries march onward. So until now, we've basically documented a Judaism that isn't, of course, free of rabbis, far from it, or free of ideas that would become important to rabbis, again, far from it. But we have documented a very diverse culture, and we haven't, as of yet, pointed to any particular group as becoming dominant at any particular point. In fact, ironically, the crystallization that we've seen in terms of views, or in terms of figures who become very influential, have not been Jews at all. They've been Jews, but not Jews in the sense that we're using the term analytically or with hindsight. And the person who we've seen has sort of accumulated the most influence by this point is Paul. And we discussed about a couple of months ago, we discussed Constantine, the Council of Nicaea. We're going to come back to that with a vengeance in a little bit. But for now, what I'd like to do is begin to document the rabbis themselves, how they interact with others in society, which we begin to take a look at, and more importantly, how they interact with each other, and what that means for broader Jewish society. I think the easiest way to gain entree into this question is to examine an institution that ends up adopting a very prominent profile, not just in rabbinic society or rabbinic communities or among rabbis, as it were, but within broader Jewish and Christian society, and that is the institution of the Nasi, of the patriarch who sort of is the titular head of the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. We're going to have we're going to devote a lot of time next week to describing this. We're going to have to describe, to document precisely what it is that the Nasi is and does. And in the interest of doing that, we're going to take a look at source number one. But before we take a look at source number one, I'd like to take a look at the timeline that I've given you on the top. And, you know, again, normally in this class, we don't usually engage with the timelines. They're mostly for reference. But in this case, I'd like to do it because I think it expresses something that should pique our interest right at the very top. And that is, if you take a look at this list is basically finds its origins in a primordial sense in the writings of the Gaonim, and it takes its modern form, which is essentially the form that you find here in one fashion or another, in the writings of some of the early historians, some of the early, you know, sort of post-Enlightenment Jewish historians, like Heinrich Gratz and so on and so forth, some of the, you know, great Jewish German historians. And this is a list of, or a putative list, of all of the people who served in the institution of Nasi, going all the way back to Hillel HaZaken, of Beis Hillel fame. Now, this list that I'm showing you here consists of people who are related to each other, at least ostensibly. What's the relationship between all of these people? Father and son, right? That's what this is supposed to be. It's a patrilineal list.
Now, were they also all Kohanim?
No. Oh, excellent question. So, in other words, what is important to call attention to, I'm glad Dr. Schwarzer called attention to this, is the character of Jewish leadership that ends up finding expression in this list, which is basically a group of rabbis. Normally, as we've come to know it in some of our previous classes, Jewish leadership has consisted, not necessarily mainly, but in a very important sense, of people who are Kohanim, who are priests. One of our important sources for this is the historical work of someone who was himself a priest, namely Josephus. Josephus was a priest, right? A famous priest. Yosef ben Matisyahu. So, who are these people priests? The answer is they're not priests, but that does raise a very important question, which is, where do they come from, and who are they? Now, there are, in fact, as we're going to see, lists or traditions that want to push this, that we're going to look at some of them next week, traditions that try to push this list all the way back even further than Hillel, sort of back into the ether of Jewish history, or back into the sort of primordial ooze of Jewish history, and try to locate the origins of this list with King David, with David HaMelech himself. Now, putting that aside for the moment, so in other words, these people would be from the tribe of Yehuda. So looking at this list, it's a list that contains, at least for the most part... So that is the assumption that we're going to encounter next week, and it may in fact be true. What we're going to make of it is going to have to, though. I'd like to save it for next week because it's an exciting sort of bit of forensic lumdus in and of itself, which we're going to engage in. Now, this list consists, in the main, although at a certain point it actually, I really think, stops being the case, of truly eminent Talmidei Chachamim, some of whom are giants, many of whom are giants in our tradition. Hillel HaZaken has left his imprint over all of Shas. The same thing is true for Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, of course, Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken, his grandfather. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel I, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel I appears outside of rabbinic literature. He was an acquaintance of Josephus, and his father, Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken, Rabbi Gamliel I, the elder, makes an appearance outside of rabbinic literature in the New Testament, in the book of Acts. He was one of the members. He's one of the members of the Sanhedrin. And actually, bear that in mind, because we're going to take that out of our back pocket in just a moment. Now, this list is a list of, as I said, of fathers and sons, many of whom are quite prominent. What I've given you at the bottom, at the very end of this list, rather, after Rabbi Gamliel VI, is the basic, again, at a certain point, once all the years of life, or rather of reign, end up ending in fives or zeros, we can assume at a certain point that it's estimated. So the estimated total of years that this list is supposed to span of father to son passing down a leadership role is 445 years. 445 years of patrilineal rule or patrilineal and habitation of a leadership institution passed down father to son for 445 years would be the
amazing.
It would be amazing. First of all, just from a purely internal standpoint, the odds of a father, or rather of a family, producing a son who wouldn't fall prey to the mortality rate was about, in this period, 60%. So the odds...
Damn good genetics.
Yeah, right. So you would need impeccable genetics for this to... Right, you would need impeccable genetics for this to occur. It would also be the longest example of a patrilineal chain inhabiting a leadership institution in all of world history. More so than China? So the last time we dealt with this question, I was asked China. So I went back and looked, and it is in fact the longest such list. Japan, I don't know. That's a good point. But it's at the very least in the ancient Near East, it's an extremely long list. It's an extremely long time. Right.
I mean, the amount of years that a lot of them were 40 years and 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And then, you know, people's...
Especially at the end of the list.
Yeah, but even people's longevity were...
Right.
You know,
this is a...
People lived, 40 years old?
Right, so this...
What about Yehuda?
Right, so the Gemara talks about...
I'm saying that the length of their reign, it was...
Chazal talk about a full life being 70 years. So that gives you a sense of sort of the range that we're talking about. But at the very least, this is an astounding list. Now, the fact that it's astounding doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't have happened. Of course, certainly that's not the case. Lots of astounding things in our history have happened and do happen and continue to happen to this day. Our very survival as a people is in many respects miraculous. But that this is so astounding should at least alert us to the possibility that something else may be going on here, and it should at least serve as justification for us to embark on an investigation of this list and maybe what perhaps lies behind it and what may explain it. Now, that brings us to source number one, and source number one is going to kick off our investigation formally. Source number one is a letter... I believe from the Church Father Origen to his compatriot named Africanus in the early to mid 3rd century, and he's discussing with him a variety of issues, and inter alia he brings up the following issue. He writes, and even now under Roman rule, when the Jews pay the drachma in tax, or they pay a certain amount in taxes to the Romans, the ethnarch... And the ethnarch here is the Nasi. The ethnarch acts as the authority for the Jews, and, as it were, with the connivance of the emperor, he is in no way different from a king over his people. For cases are tried surreptitiously according to the Jewish law, and people are even condemned to death, albeit not entirely openly, but certainly not without the knowledge of the emperor. Okay. This letter implies, in other words, if on the basis of this letter you had to describe the Nasi and the extent of his power, so...
A hell of a lot. A hell of a lot of autonomy.
Right, on a scale of 1 to 10, it would be, as you say, a hell of a lot. Right, okay. So
autonomous rule within the system. Right.
Yes, it's certainly the case. And the assumption that Origen makes is that there are political connections at work that are supporting this, that are propping up this system. Okay.
Well, clearly
so, right. Precisely. So the Nasi, the patriarch, or the ethnarch in this case, the Nasi is someone who has power, we have to assume from this letter, although again, the letter has a rhetorical agenda in and of itself, so we needn't necessarily take it at its word, but even if we assume a toned-down version of this, right? In other words, Origen's just sort of exaggerating the power and the malicious ends to which Jewish power is. But even assuming that that's the case, and certainly may well have been, we can assume on this basis that the Nasi would have impacted the lives not just of rabbis and people who chose to associate with rabbis, but of the Jewish community in general. In varying degrees, maybe, but certainly would have had an impact. So it really becomes, I think, a really pressing question to ask us, where does the Nasius come from? Where does the Nasi come from? who was the first Nasi? Who put this institution in place? What does it mean? What are its functions? What are its powers? And so on and so forth. So now if we have to think of who the most famous of all the Nasiim are, so let's name some famous people who occupied the office of Nasi. We're going to name them until we get to the one that I want.
Not Yehuda Nasi.
Excellent. All right. We don't have to go any further than that. Right. Of all the people who held the position of Nasi, the most famous one is also the one who has it attached to his name. And that is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. We call us in Chazal, he's often referred to as Rabbi, right? My teacher. Just should give you a sense of his importance. He was just as Stam the Rav, right? We refer to the Rav, sort of Soloveitchik Zatzal. So Rabbi, right, should gives you a sense of his preeminence in our community. So Rabbi, my teacher, is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Okay. So
he reigned the longest, I think, of any of them also.
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi certainly seems to have 50 years, right? The estimation that we have on this chart is that he reigned for 50 years. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's most famous accomplishment is what?
Mishnah.
Right, putting together, adapting the Mishnah. In the beginning of around about the beginning of the 3rd century, it's attributed to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. In fact, I think that may well be a correct attribution. So now, we have to ask ourselves, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is the most famous Nasi, so what about the people who were Nasi before him? Right? Why weren't they as famous, as powerful as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi?
Nasi, but maybe they served the same role, and so the term Nasi was given retroactively.
Excellent. Okay, so Mrs. Deegan, you're raising the question of where does the title Nasi originate? Before we ask where does Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi come from, we have to ask where the institution itself comes from. Did people who held that institution, that title, well, were people who were as powerful or held a similar power to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, were they called Nasiim, right? Was the title Nasi in existence before this? So take a look at source number 2. So this is from a Tanaitic source that's preserved for us in the Bavli. There are other similar sources could be called from elsewhere, but this is a convenient one. V'hatanya, Hillel v'Shimon, Gamliel v'Shimon, Nahagu Nasiusan b'fnei habayis mea shana. The Brisa tells us that Hillel and Shimon, Gamliel and Shimon, served their terms as Nasi for 100 years before the destruction of the temple. Okay. So we know a couple of things from this list. First of all, do we have an answer to Mrs. Deegan's question? Right? Was the title Nasi operative before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi?
Seems like
the answer is yes. Right? It seems to be. Right? Now, before we're so quick to answer that question in the affirmative, we have to actually go back now and ask ourselves: so who are these people, and when were they Nasi? So what does this price to tell us?
100 years before. But here. If you look at your timeline,
so
right,
it's not 100 years.
It's almost. It's 90 years. It's 80.
Only one.
67,
yeah, but
and
only,
20.
But only one of them.
Yeah, but I'm saying so.
Right. So if we had to count the number of people who, according to this list, right, if we want to count, the people who according to this list, were could have fit into this picture. So it would count. We would count again. The Beis Hamikdash is destroyed in the right year 69-70 CE, right? So the number of people who could have been on this list, who would be eligible for this list, would be Hillel. He seems to be the first person in the list of our Brisa, right?
People the head of the Sanhedrin.
It
almost seems that there was a Sanhedrin.
Excellent.
There was a guy who was the head of the Sanhedrin always.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent.
So is that the person who we're referring to?
So take a look at the source below this. So before we're going to take a look at the source below this. Before we do that, we're going to try and figure out who's in this Brisa. So Hillel would be on it, or Gamliel the Elder would be on it, or Gamliel al-Zakin, and Shem Gamliel the First would be on this list as well. The problem that we're left with is that there's an unaccounted for Shimon on our list, whose identity we don't know. But be that as it may, we know that they were Nasiim, and we also know that they reigned before the destruction of the temple. So this actually brings us to Dr. Schwartzbaum's question, which is, what does it mean that they were Nasiim before the destruction of the temple? Does that mean these people happened to be Nasiim before the temple was destroyed? Now, there were other people who were Nasiim after the temple was destroyed. Or is there something about the office of Nasi that terminates with the destruction of the temple? Now, Dr. Schwartzbaum, you're suggesting that perhaps maybe their office did terminate with the destruction of the temple. Now, the assumption behind that suggestion. So we know that the title is still in existence. Now, what we have to do.
But there's no Sanhedrin.
Okay, perfect. So right. So let me lay out.
The title of Nasi didn't end, but
the Sanhedrin did continue for a period of time.
As I'm hearing the questions, let me lay out the issues, and we're going to create sort of a research agenda, and then we're going to proceed accordingly. Number one, we have to figure out what the relationship is between the Nasi and the Sanhedrin, if there is such a relationship, and if there is, what is it? Number two, we have to figure out what happens to the Sanhedrin after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Does it continue, or does it cease to exist? Number three, even if the Sanhedrin sort of changes after the destruction of the temple, maybe, as Mr. Deegan is suggesting, maybe it remains after the Sanhedrin. There's evidence that we're going to see that may suggest that, but we're going to have to examine it carefully. And number four, even if at the end of this, we can't find, well, rather, actually, issue number four, before we get to that, issue number four is, assuming we have identified a Nasi at this point in time, up to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and assuming, and knowing that our next point on the line is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, so we actually have to account for about 100 to 200, we have to account for about 200 years in between those things. Can we bridge that gap? And if we can, who is in between? The family, well, actually, let's answer that question right now.
You're saying the term Nasi was in use in that period.
Well, so that would be issue number five. Is the term Nasi in use in that period? And if it is, whose family
is carrying it?
Right? Now, if we had to answer that question just by looking at this list, what would the answer be?
Hillel's family.
Now, the assumption when we say Hillel's family is that there is a relationship between name number one on our list and name number two. That Rabbi Gamliel HaZakin is somehow related to Hillel, maybe his son. Okay, we're not going to have time to discuss that assumption now, but let's assume that it's correct for the time being. The second assumption is that here we have names Hillel, Gamliel, Shimon, Gamliel, Shimon, and then we get to number six, all of a sudden we have Yehuda. And then Gamliel's pick up again, but it's interspersed with Yehuda's. Okay, so the assumption that we have to make is that number six, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, is related to number five, Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Talmud Bavli certainly takes it for granted that that's the case. So that would sort of explain how the term Nasi gets passed on. So now let's examine some of these assumptions. We have a research agenda, and now we're going to proceed as follows. So
but there's also a change in the Jewish, what's going on. Because after the destruction of Bar Kokhba, there's a whole change in the Jew, the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, but the Jews are still in Yerushalayim.
Right.
Bar Kokhba rebellion comes, the Jews are now in Gamla, or wherever they went up north.
So the person on this list who would have been most affected by the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt, we know the Bar Kokhba revolt is in 132 to 135 of the Common Era, so the person on this list who would have been most affected by the aftermath would be Rabbi Shimon Gamliel II, who is, as far as the Bavli is concerned, the father of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So maybe if we want to find the origins of sort of the modern patriarchy, right, the modern Nasius, maybe we should look to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel II. That's going to be something that we're going to discuss in the latter half of this year. We'll get to that actually in just a moment. First, I want to tackle Dr. Schwartzman's question.
Who's the Nasi in the Haggadah?
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi.
No, but where they're sitting around
in B'nai Brak, right? Wait a minute. Here's my question though. Does the word Nasi appear in the Haggadah?
No.
So let's store that for a moment, because we're going to come back. We can come back to that actually in a moment.
There's Gamliel the elder, and then you don't have a start date for Shimon. All you have is a dead date.
Right,
and
right.
And then his dead date is 70.
Yard sign.
96. For Gamaliel II. So what happened
between? Right. So in between number 3 and number 4, and in between number 4 and number 5, there are gaps. And the reason is because those are revolts, right? The first one is the sort of the aftermath of the first revolt against the Romans, which resulted in the destruction of the temple. And the second gap is the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt, which occurs during the reign, sort of during the reign of Hadrian, on the heels of the disastrous, for the Jews, reign of Trajan.
So you're saying then, in that period, the Sanhedrin wasn't able to meet, which we all agree, but
point
of fact,
so let's get
to
that question right now. Take a look at the source in the Tosefta and the Sanhedrin, right under that Gemara and Bavli and Shabbos. The Tosefta tells us, Sanhedrin haista kachatzi goren agula, kadeshi roin ze es ze, hanasi yoshev b'emtza, zkenim yoshev mimino, u mismolo, and then quickly take a look to the right of that. So Mishnah Chagiga, Harishonim Hayinasim Ushniim Lahem Avbeistin. Okay, so we have two sources here. One, the first one in the Tosefta and Sanhedrin, tells us about how the Sanhedrin was arranged. The Sanhedrin was arranged.
One puts them together and the other puts them apart.
So let's quickly translate it, and we're going to test that in just a moment. But that's, I think you're on the right track. The Sanhedrin was arranged in a semicircle so that they should each see each other. The Nasi sat in the middle of the Sanhedrin, and then the elders sat to his right. The elders, the rest of the other members of the Sanhedrin, sat to his right and left. So now, and then that's source number one in the Sanhedrin, and then source number two, which we're going to have to put together with that, is the Mishnah Chagiga, after it lists a series of sages, each of whom engaged in a particular machlokes. A particular machlokas that's supposed to be, this is for another time, but the oldest machlokas in rabbinic history, relating to doing smicha and a karban, in the context of Hilchos Yontif. But here it says that of these two pairs of great sages that represented each generation, the first of them was the Nasi, and the second one was the Av Beistin. Now, putting together these two bits of information, the Sanhedrin was arranged in a semicircle and Nasi sat in the middle, and then number two, that of the great sages of each generation, one was always the Nasi and the other one was the Av Beis Din. So what does the Nasi seem to do, or where does he always seem to be in the context of this data? Av Beis Din meaning
equal to, but not
patriarch or father of the court. Equal to,
but not necessarily of.
So in other words, you could say, in other words, he's not a normal member of the Sanhedrin.
Right.
Not a normal.
Be able to adjudicate.
Maybe he's sort of the vice president in the Congress. But if he's like the vice president in the Congress, that means that he's essentially involved in the Congress. Which, in other words, if there were to be like an absolute tiebreaker, right? So the vice president would have the deciding vote. Mm-hmm. The same thing might be true here. In other words, the Nasi's role, as far as we can tell, seems to be to play some role. Sounds like a leadership role in the Sanhedrin.
It sounds like he can adjudicate if there's a debate.
Right.
I mean, he's definitely important to the city and Senate, but the Av Beis Din seems to be the head of the whole thing.
Right. So the Av Beis Din could mean that he's the head of the Sanhedrin, or it could just mean that he's sort of the chief of the Sanhedrin. In other words, he's sort of like the vice president, or maybe he's sort of the Speaker of the House, right? There's the Speaker of the House or the head of the Senate, and then there's the vice president, who sort of is the foremost among all of those people, even if he doesn't have a formal role. So whatever the Nasi is,
it does appear that the Nasi is the titular head, and the Av Beis Din is below.
Right, the Nasi seems to be above the Av Beis Din, but the Nasi, certainly, whatever the Nasi's role is, and again, the fact that we're having some trouble defining it puts us in good stead. We're following in the footsteps of many of the Achronim. The fact of the matter is that the Nasi's role is certainly bound up somehow with the operation of the Sanhedrin. So the Nasi, if we just have to put it in sort of basic terms, the Nasi equals head of the Sanhedrin. Okay. Head member of Chazal, head member of the Sanhedrin, understood as a rabbinic body, right? Which we know from the Gospels wasn't, and from Josephus, this certainly wasn't the case in reality. But ideally, that's how it should have been. So the Nasi would be the head of the Sanhedrin. So let me ask you then: is that Nasi the same Nasi, the same type of Nasi as we know from the Epistle to Africanus?
Doesn't seem to be.
In other words, some of their functions could overlap,
This guy from Africana seems to be like a ruler.
Excellent.
Of like a government person. Okay. Well, this guy seems to be the head of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but it also appears that he's, in the letter, there's no Sanhedrin. He's acting as the head alone.
Excellent.
There's no body.
Yeah, right.
So that previously there is a body that he ruled. And he was the head of the body.
Excellent.
And now he is the body and the head.
He's like a king over his people, right, as Arjun says. Right. So they don't seem to be the same person. Their functions may overlap in some sort of theoretical way, but they don't really seem to be the same person. So with that, armed with that knowledge, we can actually go one step further and take a look at the source below that, the Bavli and Ksubos. Not only can we already see that the Nasi back then, pre-destruction of the temple, and the Nasi in the days of Rehuda Nasi are somewhat different, we also have the following bit of data from a Brisa, a Tanaitic source in the Gemara and Ksubos. Miyom Shechar Beis HaMikdash, Afal Pi Shebatlu Sanhedrin, Arba Misos Lo Batlu. From the day that the temple was destroyed, although the Sanhedrin had ceased to function, there were four death penalties that were still in play. Now, what does this tell us? Inter alia, right? While it's telling us about the existence of these Arbamisos, so what does it tell us about the Sanhedrin?
Well, there had to be somebody to give out these death penalties.
There was a court system, but was there a Sanhedrin?
No.
What does this tell us?
No.
Alvabisha Batlu Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin disbanded. Now, there may have been some way, right, there certainly was an adjudicating body that took its place, but the Sanhedrin as such, as a formal institution, with a title, capital sigma, right, capital S, Sanhedrin, Sunedroi, right, the Sanhedrin ceases to exist. Now, there is a source, which we're not going to take a look at in the interest of time, below this from Bereshis Rabbah from the 5th century. This is the only source that does so. So actually, I'll preface it by saying, after the destruction of the temple, there is no sage. There's no Tana or Amora anywhere in rabbinic literature, anywhere in Chazal, who is ever associated with the Sanhedrin, or named as a member of a Sanhedrin, or talked about as presiding over Sanhedrin, or talked about as bringing a case to the Sanhedrin. No one is ever talked about in connection with a Sanhedrin after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. The Gemara in Ksubos is very helpful in terms of supplying a why, which is to say, the Sanhedrin disbanded. There was no Sanhedrin. Now, the Gemara, the Midrash here in Bereshis Rabbah, talks about the Sanhedrin traveling after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed to Yavne, and from Yavne to Usha, from Usha to Shvar'am, from Shvar'am to Beisharim, from Beisharim to Tzipori, and so on and so forth. So it's the assumption here in the Midrash is that there was some sort of Sanhedrin. I think that given all of the data that we've examined so far, the more likely understanding of what this Midrash is trying to do is it's using the Sanhedrin as a metaphor for the rabbinic, for the center of rabbinic power as such, which is to say, after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and the Beis HaMikdash was Kayim, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to teach, the Chazal tell us, in the shadow of the Heichal, in the shadow of the temple, which raised halachic issues, how can you benefit from the shade of the temple? But once the temple was destroyed, so the rabbis moved to Yavne, right? That's where all the rabbis congregate. After Yavne is destroyed, so now, we're going to explore this next week, the Rabbanim of the Galil, of the north, become very popular, and they are based in a town called Usha. Then they move to other towns. So this is the Sanhedrin here is being used as a metaphor for where rabbis are at the time. But in terms of was there a Sanhedrin for there to be a Nasi of, the answer is no. There was not. Okay.
Well, clearly there was a governing, there was the a group body that was invested with the governance.
There's a Beistin, right? There's a Beistin.
Yeah.
Right, there is a Beistin. That's true. Now, what we have to ask ourselves, however, is let's assume that there is a Beis Din. But let's also assume, given the evidence we've surveyed, that there was no Sanhedrin. So the question is, if there was no Sanhedrin, so what would a Nasi be? So it couldn't just be the head of the Beis Din, because there were lots of Batei Din, right? There are Batei Din all over the place. So what would a Nasi have done? That's question number one. And number two, well, we might say, well, listen, we might respond to that question by saying, look, I don't know. The Nasi must have been something, must have done something. Why? Well, because we know.
Go back to the letter. The Nasi is the political head. He deals with Rome.
He's the man. He's the
courtier.
He became the courtier.
He's
right.
The guy that when they need the taxes, they go to him and say, raise the taxes.
So if we want to take the letter to Africanus seriously, we would say, well, a Nasi would have been sort of an aristocrat of sorts, right? Or, in other words, as Mrs. Swack said, a court Jew, something with,
between.
Right? And may at the same time have been a rabbinic personality or a rabbinic leader. The two are not mutually exclusive, but that's what a Nasi would have been. Now, that leaves us with a methodological problem, however, which is, if we're going to shift the meaning of the word Nasi, so now, we can't just assume, well, because there was a Nasi, because Hillel HaZaken was a Nasi, so unless presented with evidence otherwise, we can assume that the title passed down uninterrupted until it gets to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. We can't assume that anymore because we're arguing that the definition of Nasi has changed. So, if we want to figure out when's the earliest time that
we're arguing that the duties of the Nasi has changed.
Correct.
Evolved.
Right.
But we're not arguing that the role ceased to exist.
So in other words, we want to say now there was a title Nasi, but the content of that title or the implications of that title or the job description of Nasi. Did it expand or did it change completely? In other words,
because at the time of Hillel there was a government.
Correct.
Of the area. And king and a whole whatever, but there was
not a king because the kingship ended. Roman rule.
Yeah.
Well, right. In other words, the descendants of Herod and Agrippa just before the destruction of the temple. Right, there were kings. Correct.
There were kings. There were rulers, and then now here they are not. So the Nasi, who may have been a religious figure, a court figure,
So the job description is different. So now we have to ask ourselves, hold on, what is the earliest instance in history that we can identify that type of Nasi, or a Nasi with that job description? The answer is no longer Hillel HaZaken.
No, it's
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi.
Well, is he making the decisions that the Sanhedrin made in its day?
Was the Nasi? Perhaps that's a good question.
Because after the Nasi, we have complete chaos.
Right.
I mean, as far as religious rulings go.
Right. So that's actually a good question, and it's an excellent question to such an extent I actually want to make that the subject of our investigation next week, because we're going to have to ask ourselves. In other words, what does the Nasi do? B, where does, in other words, who has the idea to give the Nasi this sort of job description, and how does it play out in broader society? Those are very important questions. But it actually leads me to ask this question, which is, if the earliest instance of Nasi with this job description that we can find is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, we're going to have to substantiate that next week, but if that truly is the case, so now we have to ask ourselves a different question, which is not, can we extend Nasi from one epoch to another one, but can we push the title Nasi with this job description, this expanded or at least altered job description, can we push it back any further than Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? Now, the answer to that question crucially depends upon the following question. First of all, who were Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's ancestors, and if we can identify them, were they Nasiim?
Is there anything in Josephus?
So Josephus would only help us to a point, right? Because Josephus would only be able to tell us about things that occurred until or shortly after, maybe 20 years after the destruction of the temple. So the answer in terms of does he mention anything before or after the destruction of the temple, the answer is no. Josephus doesn't give us any information. More problematically, Josephus actually knows people on this list. He knows Rav Shimon Gamliel I, and he doesn't call him the Nasi. So it doesn't mean that he wasn't, and he doesn't spend so much time talking about him, but he records conversations with him. So,
does the Tanakh have anything, or do we go back to the book of Maccabees?
Right, so the word Nasi certainly has military, possibly messianic overtones in Tanakh, so much so that it is adopted by a figure in the 2nd century CE, who uses, that we know uses the title Nasi, that is Bar Kokhba, Shimon Bar Kozeba, Bar Kokhba, uses the title Nasi, but in a different sense than it's being, or in a similar sense to the way it's being used here. But here's the question we have to ask. If we can assume for a moment that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's ancestors were the members of the family of Rabbi Gamaliel, so can we identify in that family Nasiim? So, question number one. Was Rabbi Gamaliel the second, right? Not Rabbi Gamaliel HaZakin, Rabbi Gamaliel the second, who lived in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple, was he a Nasi? So if you ask the Bavli in the Gemara and Sanhedrin in source number 3, so let's see what the answer is. Tana Rabbanan, the Brisa tells us, Ein ma'abrin es ashana elem kein yirtze Nasi. Umaisa Rabbi Gamaliel, shahalach lital rishus, etzel shilton echad shebasuria, v'shahe lavo, v'ibras ashana manas sheyirtze Rabbi Gamaliel, u'kishabar Rabbi Gamaliel, v'amarotza ani, nimtzeis shanam uberes. So the rabbis wanted to intercalate the calendar, they wanted to add an extra month to the calendar to make sure that the lunar calendar would sync up with the solar seasons, right? So you could have Pesach in the right time and so on and so forth. Now, the Brisa tells us that the rule is that you are only allowed to intercalate the calendar if the Nasi agrees. Now, how does the Gemara substantiate this claim? By telling us a story about Rabbi Gamaliel. Rabbi Gamaliel went to Syria to meet with a government official there, and Chazal wanted to intercalate the calendar, so they said, we'll do it on condition that Rabbi Gamaliel agrees. And when Rabbi Gamaliel came back, he agreed, so they intercalated the year. What does this story imply about Rabbi Gamaliel and the title that he held? He was the Nasi, right? That's the whole point of this sugya. Now, here's the problem.
They didn't use the title.
Right, who uses the title? Where does the title Nasi does a...
The title comes from the Bavli.
Right, the Bavli uses it in its Tana Rabbanan, right?
The decision that he made, wouldn't that have been in the past a decision of the Sanhedrin?
In other words...
Put a month into the thing. It's a little rabbi wouldn't have decided...
Right.
Add a month into the calendar.
So it's possible. It's possible. But and that's actually a good point. In other words, Mr. Deegan's saying, it sounds like here, whether or not Rabbi Gamaliel really is the Nasi, we're going to find out. But it sounds like this is a fairly substantial body of rabbis who are making big decisions. Right. That's true. Also, we should recall, however, that in many moons ago, no pun intended, when we were discussing the calendar, the Jewish calendar, we saw that one of the features of Jewish calendars in this period is that there actually is a great deal of diversity. So it is possible that that this group of rabbis was making a decision that wouldn't be followed by the majority of, or at least a good portion of Jews in Eretz Yisrael during this period. But on the other hand, it is a good point. This does seem to be, Rabbi Gamaliel does seem to be a somebody. He's not a nobody. But take a look at the Mishnah in Adios to the right of this. This is actually the source from which the Bavli is drawing. If you notice, in the Mishnah in Adios, which is a Tanaitic source, unlike the Bavli, which is of course the latest of our Talmudic sources, Mishnah Adios actually uses this story in a totally different fashion. Heim he'idu shema abrin es hashana al tanai umaisa rabbi Gamaliel, and then it tells the exact story that we just told. The Mishnah in Adios says the rule is you are allowed to intercalate the calendar on condition. What does that mean? You have a group of rabbis who want to add an extra month to the year, but they don't have the full complement of the court, right? One person is missing, right? One person who's important is missing. So, are you allowed to intercalate the calendar? The answer is you may, but you have to stipulate that this extra month that we're adding is conditional upon the acceptance of all of our members, and if one of them is missing, we have to wait for him to come back and ask his permission. So, in this version, in the Mishnah in Adios, is there any implication that Rabbi Gamaliel is the Nasi?
Yeah, he's missing.
Yes. But does it say that he's the Nasi or just that he's missing?
It sounds
what if another Rav was, if another Rav was missing, the same thing would be true, no?
And it sounds to me like all these rabbis were sitting around, they decided this, so they sent the chief person. Because it actually couldn't even, the Nasi had to approve of it, but first the guy in Syria.
True, that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. But what about the Mishnah in Adios? Does the Mishnah in Adios ever mention the word Nasi?
No.
No, it just says if one person who's important is missing,
you can't
intercalate the year unless they say, okay, it could have been Rabbi Gamliel, it could have been anybody else.
What is that?
This is another way that you can tell that the Bavli is later than the Mishnah, obviously, because the Bavli isn't using the Greek word that the Mishnah is using. The hegemon, which, like, in other words, the word hegemon today, comes from the word hegemon, the Greek word hegemon, which can mean governor, provincial governor, leader, something. It would have been sort of a minor politician in Syria. Now, the idea of visiting someone who was a politician in Syria, you didn't need to be a big macher to do that. As we know from the Judean Desert, when we examined a couple weeks ago, remember the Ksubos from the Babata archive, from that woman Babata, many of those people, not many of whom were commoners, would regularly go to see the governor in Rabat Amon or in Petra to plead cases before people like that, because Jews are litigious people. And we like to make our voices heard, and we have very strong opinions. So if the governor is letting people come to complain, you better believe that the Jews are going to be the first people in the office.
So the Roman governor was not in Israel, he was in Syria, basically.
Correct. Right. This particular governor would have been based in Syria. Yes, correct. Right. Excellent, yeah. Now, the
otherwise known as Greater Israel.
Right.
I'm saying, but Greater Rome.
But yes, right. In other words, Rome sort of carves up the land of Israel into a bunch of different pieces. So now, just in the interest of time, I want to move ahead here and take a look at the sources in source number 4. These are going to really be crucial here, because now we've actually problematized some of the links in our chain. In other words, we don't have any evidence. First of all, the Nesiim that we've identified before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash were not Nesiim, were not patriarchs in the same sense that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was. Moreover, of the people who bridged the gap between the destruction of the temple and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, at least one of them, Rabbi Gamliel II, we don't have any evidence that he was the Nasi in sources from Eretz Yisrael that would have been contemporary with him, or at least near contemporary with him. All we have is the Bavli. Doesn't mean that it's not true, of course, but it should certainly spark our interest. Now, the next question that we have to ask is, well, wait a minute. We've been assuming all this time that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would have been the patriarch in continuity with earlier patriarchs because he was related to them, and it's just that the job description expanded. Maybe we have to ask a more fundamental question. How do we know that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was related to the members of the family of Rabbi Gamliel? So note that the sources that make that argument, that make that claim, are all in the Bavli. Not a single source from anywhere in the Yerushalmi, or anywhere in any other source from Eretz Yisrael for that matter, makes that claim.
The claim of
that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is related to the family of Rabbi Gamliel.
So
and that his father, in particular, was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel II.
So you're saying only outside of Israel is the father-son chain held to be valid?
Is it held to exist? Or is it held to exist?
And in Israel, they didn't hold by that.
In Eretz Yisrael, we don't know anything about... let's take a look. What do we know from sources from Eretz Yisrael about the parentage of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? Right? That's a question we have to ask ourselves. What do we know? Right? It's a worthwhile question. In other words, we have all these assumptions. The question is, where do they come from? So first of all...
That's an excellent point.
If we conceive of the Nasi as sort of an analog to Malchi Yehuda, then it makes sense to say that it was an institution. Right. Excellent. So here's where we're going to have to do a little forensic work. Skip the first source in source number 4, just in the interest of moving this along. There is of the 3 explicit sources in the Bavli that make the claim that Rabbi Yehuda is related to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So the one that makes that claim most directly, and we're going to examine it, and I hope show how it came to be, is this one. So the Gemara records a machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and Rabbi Lazar Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Lazar, the son of the Tana named Rabbi Shimon, who, better known as his full name, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So Rabbi Lazar, the son of a great famous Tana, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi are having an argument. At a certain point, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, takes Rabbi Yehuda to task for being wrong, and he sort of insults him. And so what happens? So the Bavli tells us in Bava Metzia, Asa Amarle La'avuha, Rabbi comes and tells his father, Amarle, and he tells his father all of the things that Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon said to him. So his father replied, and his father in this case, the Bavli assumes, is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. His father says to him, Bini, Al Yei Rashu Ari ben Ari, Va'ata Ari ben Shual. You don't listen. You don't have anything to complain about. Because look, Rabbi Lazar Rabbi Shimon is the lion, the son of a lion. You are the lion, the son of a fox. He's just more distinguished than you are. So the Gemara says, Shlosha an v'sanin hin. Right. In other words, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is saying to his son, look, what are we supposed to say? He's better, right? He's better. And the Gemara says, based on that, Shlosha an v'sanin hin. There are three people whose humility surpasses that of all others. The Elohim, and these are them. Abba, right? My father, Rav Shimon Gamliel. Ubnei Beseira, the people that in Eretz Yisrael are called the elders of Beseira. The Yonasan ben Shaul and Jonathan, the son of King Saul. Rav Shimon Gamliel had Amaran. What does it mean? Rav Shimon Gamliel is modest, like we just said. Bnei Beseira, Damar Ma'ar, Hoshivu Barosh, Menu Lanasi Alehen. Yonasan ben Shaul, Dekamel El David, Vatatim Locha Yisrael, Vani Yelacha Lamishneh. Mimai, Dom Yonasan ben Shaul, Dechaza, Degara Alma Basar David. Bnei Beseira Nami, the Chazal Hill of the Adiv Minayhu, El Rav Shimon Gamliel, Vade Anvasani. So, the Gemara says the Bnei Beseira, these are the people that Hillel Hazakein, the story goes when he came from Babylonia to the land of Israel, the Bnei Beseira had a question. Are we allowed to Shech the Karban Pesach on Shabbos if Shabbos is Erev Pesach? And Hillel Hazakein answers the question for them. And then, so they were considered to be modest. Why? Because they abdicated their authority to this uncouth Babylonian foreigner who came to Israel and telling us what to do. Who does he think he is? They saw that his Torah knowledge was unmatchable and incomparable, and so they abdicated their authority to him. And then Yonatan ben Shaul, he was the heir to the throne, to the Saul's throne. And then he, knowing that David was his superior and was intended for the throne by God, he took second fiddle to David. Now, the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. Yonatan ben Shaul, everybody knew that David was better than Jonathan. Of course. What do we expect? He was just being realistic. And the Bnei Beseira, look, Hillel was a Gadol Adar. What were they supposed to do? Tell Hillel to take a hike? Of course not. So Rav Shimon Gamliel is the real modest one. Why? Because of the story that we just told. Now, the problem is
Yichus.
Right, now, what's the problem with this list? The problem with this list is that two of them, in terms of people who are modest, so there's one person on this list who's not like the others. And that is Rav Shimon Gamliel. Why do I say that? What do the Bnei Beseira and Yonasan, the son of Shaul, have in common? What did they do?
They pointed someone in their place.
Excellent. Dr. Schwartzbaum says, they actually gave up their claim to leadership. What did Rav Shimon Gamliel do? Nothing. He just said. He was just polite. This is a strange list. Now, the list becomes clear if you look at the next source, and if once you realize that the Bavli here, for a particular reason, and we'll in the last couple of seconds we'll explain what I think that reason is, the Bavli is refashioning two sources that it has from the Yerushalmi, from Eretz Yisrael sources, and these are them. The first one, Yerushalmi says, Shlosha hinichu kisran ba'olam hazeh v'yar shechai olam haba v'elohein Yonasan ben Shaul v'lazer ben Azariah v'ziknei b'seira. There are three people who abdicated their crowns in this world and thereby acquired crowns in the world to come, and these are them: Jonathan, son of King Saul, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and the elders of Beseir, whom we just mentioned. Now, Yonasan ben Shaul, Amar Rabbi Law, Afilo Nishayim Echari Akorian Yodos Hayishadavid Asad Limloch, Elazar ben Azariah, Tinian Hava, Leis Lach Kadad Zikne Beseira, Deshayin Garmin Min Nisios, Umanine Nasi. So the Gemara says, well, of these three people, Yonasan ben Shaul, we know, abdicated his power to David, or Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, after taking briefly the place of Rabbi Gamliel, eventually Rabbi Gamliel comes back to power, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah willingly gives up his post as the head of the yeshiva. And or the head is sort of the convocation of rabbis, maybe the study circle, and then the elders of Beseirah, whom we mentioned, who sort of gave up their authority to Hillel. So the list here says, well, of these three, who's the real hero of these three? Yonasan ben Shaul, everybody, like the Gemara in the Bible, says everybody knew that Yonasan was not as good as David, so of course he gave up his power. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, so look, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was second in command to Rabbi Gamliel, so it's not such a big deal. In other words, he didn't give up that much power. He gave up some power, but he still kept some of it. The real big heroes were the B'nai B'Seirah, the people who let this Babylonian come up from nowhere and tell them what to do. They realized that Hillel was a gadol. What are you supposed to do when a gadol comes into town? So they are the real heroes. So this list makes a lot more sense because all three of these people gave up their power. The heroes, the chiddush for the Yerushalmi, is the B'nai B'Seirah, the people who gave up their power to a Bavli, to a Babylonian. Now, the Bavli takes over this list, as we can obviously tell. But for the Bavli, people from Eretz Yisrael who don't know how to learn, giving up power to a Talmud Chacham from Bavel, the Bavli is shot through with confident statements by Babylonian Amoraim about the superiority of Torah learning in Bavel. The people from Eretz Yisrael didn't necessarily feel the same way, but that's the case. So, that the B'nai B'Seirah gave up their position to Hillel. It's not a chiddush for them. So, their list is reworked. And instead, the great modesty of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who was a gadol in his own right, sort of conceding that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was his superior, that becomes the head of the list. It doesn't work as well, because he doesn't give up any power. It doesn't work as well. But that's what the Bavli is doing, and we can see why. And then finally, in terms of the relationship between Rebbe and his father, so we can also see where the Bavli is getting that from. So the Bavli assumes that his father is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, but here's the actual story that we have in the Eretz Yisrael version. And with this, we'll conclude. Take a look at this last source from the Yerushalmi in Shabbos. Rabbi Yeshua Jomaya Amar Komei Rabbi Yasa B'Shem Rabbi Acha Kani Girdei Rabbi Poter Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon Machayev. So again, Rabbi and Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon have a dispute, and it resolves as follows. Amar lo Rabbi, Kach Shemata Me'avicha. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says to his colleague, listen, I'm right because I heard your father, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, tell me that this is the case, that I'm correct. Amar lo, Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon responds to him, Shimashti es Abba Omdos Mashalo Shimashtan Yeshivos. I served my father, I understood his Torah, standing up what you couldn't even figure out sitting down and studying all day long. The Rabbi, now the Gemara says, right, they were the kings. Now, Verebi Tamid, the Gemara in Yerushalmi says Verebi Tamid the Rashbi Dahava, Lo Tamid the Rabbi Yaakov ben Kodshai Hava. Wait a minute, was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi a student of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai? He wasn't. He was a student of a Tana named Rabbi Yaakov bar Kodshai. Ella, so instead, what must Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon have said to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi? He couldn't have said, "I learned better from my Rebbe than you did from my father than you did from my father," because they didn't both learn from Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Instead, he says, "Alakach amarle shimashti es abba omdos mashalo shimash es rabach yeshivos." I served my Rebbe standing up the way you didn't serve your Rebbe sitting down. Now, here's the story as the Yerushalmi tells it. Both an earlier source and a source from Eretz Yisrael. Keshahayir Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon nichnas lebeis avad hayapanav shal Rebbe makdiros. So the next time that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi came to the Beis Avad, to the place where people would gather, would assemble, whatever that means, Rabbi was upset. So Amar Le Aviv, his father says to him, and notice, his father is nowhere named in this source, V'yos, what he said to you makes sense. Ze Ari ben Ari, Avalata Ari ben Shual, he is the lion son of a lion, you're the lion, the son of a fox, the son of a nobody. Min demach Rabbi Elazar shalach Rabbi Tava be'itase, when Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon died, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi tried to marry his wife. Amar le, klisha nishtamish b'kodesh, nishtamish b'chol. I was married to someone who was holy. I should now marry someone who's profane? What's the implication here? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's father is who? We don't know. We have no idea. He's not named. Moreover, who's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's Rebbe? It's not Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. It's not even Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. It's some Tana. It's a Tana who's obviously an incredible Talmud Chacham, no doubt. and certainly by our standards. But it's a Tana who's barely mentioned in Shas. Rav Yehuda Bar Karchai, sometimes he's called Rav Yaakov Bar Karchai, sometimes he's called Rav Yaakov Bar Karchai. This is a minor person, at least by Tanaitic standards. So, Rav Yehuda Anasi's parentage is certainly not seen as distinguished in the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi doesn't even find it remarkable that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's father would concede this point. Finally, final piece of evidence, and then we'll conclude, the Tosefta and Maestros. This is, I think, the coup de grace. Amar Rebbe, Roa Ani es Dvarai Medivrei Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. This is a Tosefta that records a machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That a son should argue with a father is not remarkable in Chazal. However, what is remarkable in Chazal is that every single time, with one exception that probably isn't even an exception, and it's not even in all the manuscripts. Who do we hold by? That's right, that actually would be a good test. In other words, who do we pass on, like the son or the father? Good question. But what's even more analogous here is that in every single case, in all of Shas, where a son engages in debate with a father, he refers to him as the halacha demands, as Abba, or Abba followed by the name. That's Abba Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, or Abba. This is the only bona fide example in Shas where a person refers to someone who is his father by his name, by his regular name, without prefacing with any kavod, without calling him Abba, without calling him Abba something. All of our analysis to this point suggests, I think, that in fact, no source from Eretz Yisrael, and really no source from Bavel, truly knows of a connection between Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the family of Rabbi Gamliel, and in particular Rabbi Shimon Gamliel II. Now, if that's the case, and with this we'll close, why does the Bavli construct such a list? Now, really there are two questions that we can ask. One is, if that's the case, well, then where does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi come from, if not from the house of Rabbi Gamliel? That question we're going to answer next week. But the second question is, why does the Bavli tell us this, or at least imply that there's this long list of people from Hillel down to Rabbi Gamliel the sixth?
The job, not the parentage.
Well, even the parentage. In other words...
No, but
you're asking why.
The list is for the job, not for the parentage.
It may be, but that's true, right? Mrs. Deegan's making a good point. In other words, and this is what I'd like to return to. In other words, the Bavli thinks that this is a list of people who have the title Nasi. Not necessarily that they're related. It happens to be the Bavli also thinks that they're related, but even just saying that there's a long list of people who are called Nasi, we've called that entire assumption into question. So why does the Bavli make it seem like we have this chain?
The Sora continues.
So right. The basic building block for what we're going to do here in the last 20 seconds is that Masora, in a certain sense, is crucial here. The idea of a tradition passed down. I'd like to make it even more personal for us, which is to say that we as a modern Orthodox community often lament a particular problem that I think the Bavli in this case addresses, which is, who are our leaders? Who are our giants? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein referred, quoting from, borrowing a term from Julius Caesar in Shakespeare, he described Rav Soloveitchik, his Rebbe and his father-in-law, as someone who bestrode our community like a colossus. Someone who was just such a towering intellect, such a powerful spiritual force, who really broke open the horizons of Torah for all of our community, that his leadership was unavoidable. It was an unavoidable phenomenon. No one in our community could escape his imprint. And we ask ourselves nowadays, where are the leaders like that? Why don't we have someone like that? Now, from a purely statistical perspective, an economic perspective, the great philosopher David Hume wrote a book, I think it's called On the Progress of the Arts and Sciences, tracked in the 1700s, where he argued, from an economic standpoint, superstars are exceedingly rare. The fact that superstars only occur, or only crop up infrequently, is not a bug in cultural progress. It's a feature, right? You don't get a Michael Jordan every single draft, in the NBA, every single NBA draft, because there's not a lot of Michael Jordan. It's very rare to find someone like that. Lahavdil, you don't get a Rav Soloveitchik every single generation, because the odds of a Rav having one Rav Soloveitchik were minuscule to begin with. So to expect that every generation should have a powerful force like that is, in a statistical sense, unreasonable. But the Bavli is telling us that we do not conduct Jewish life according to the laws of averages. It may be true that expecting or demanding a strong hand at the helm of our community is stretching, is pushing the limit of what could, what should be expected. But it doesn't matter. We as a community strive for excellence, we strive for the extraordinary, we strive for the metaphysical, we strive for the supernatural. We as a community must demand, even if it's rare, even if it's astonishing, even if it's astounding, we must demand excellence. We have to demand a list like the one we've seen tonight. A Hillel in every generation, the next generation having a Rabbi Gamliel Hazaken, the next generation's responsibility, even if it's impossible or near impossible, is to produce a Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And the generation after that has to produce a Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. We as a community can demand, we can expect no less. And that, I think, is the lesson of what the Bavli tries to do here. So with that, we're going to conclude, and the next week we're going to examine, well, if we, in a historical sense, if we can't identify the origins of Yehuda Hanasi in the house of Rabbi Gamliel, notwithstanding the fact that we understand why the Bavli gives us that impression, where does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi come from? And we'll tease out those implications for our community as well. With that, I will conclude. I'm sorry for going a little bit over time.
What was the debate in the first?
The Supreme Court was the Sanhedrin or Rama.
No, so I should be on the